Chapter 2. I remain alone in Mr. Snow's office. I must say, I am concerned to be running so behind on my room cleaning quota, not to mention on my tip collection. Usually, by this time in my workday, I'd have cleaned at least a full floor of rooms, but not today. I worry what the other maids will think and if they'll have to pick up the slack. So much time has passed, and Mr. Snow still hasn't come to fetch me. I try to settle the fear that's bubbling in my stomach. It occurs to me that a good way to sort myself is to track back through my day, recollecting to the best of my ability everything that occurred up to the moment I found Mr. Black dead in his bed in Suite 401. Today started out as an ordinary day. I came through the stately revolving doors of the hotel. Technically, employees are supposed to use the service door at the back, but few employees do. This is a rule I enjoy breaking. I love the cold feeling of the polished brass banisters leading up the scarlet steps of the hotel's main entrance. I love the squish of the plush carpet under my shoes. And I love greeting Mr. Preston, the Regency Grand's doorman. Portly, dressed in a cap and a long trench coat adorned with gold hotel crests, Mr. Preston has worked at the hotel for over 2 decades. Good morning, Mr. Preston.
Oh, Molly, happy Monday to you, my dear girl. He tips his hat.
Have you seen your daughter recently?
Why, yes, we had dinner on Sunday. She's arguing a case in court tomorrow. I still can't believe it. My little girl standing up there in front of a judge. If only Mary could see her now.
You must be proud of her.
That I am.
Mr. Preston was widowed more than a decade ago, but he never remarried. When people ask why not, his answer is always the same.
My heart belongs to Mary.
He's an honorable man, a good man, not a cheater. Have I mentioned how much I detest cheaters? Cheaters deserve to be thrown in quicksand and to suffocate in filth. Mr. Preston is not that kind of man. He's the kind you'd want as a father, though I'm hardly an expert on that subject, given that I've never had a father in my life. Mine disappeared at the same time my mother did, when I was just a wee biscuit, as my gran used to say, which I have come to understand as some time between the age of 6 months to a year, at which point Gran took over my care and we became a unit, Gran and me and Gran, until death did us part.
Mr. Preston reminds me of Gran. He knew her, too. It's never been clear to me how they met, but Gran was friendly with him and quite close with his wife, Mary. May she rest in peace.
I like Mr. Preston because he inspires people to behave properly. If you're the doorman at a fine, upstanding hotel, you see a lot of things, like businessmen bringing in sultry young playthings when their middle-aged wives are 1,000 miles away, like rock stars so drunk they mistake the doorman's podium for a urinal, like the young and beautiful Mrs. Black, the second Mrs. Black, exiting the hotel in a rush, mascara running down her tear-stained cheeks. Mr. Preston applies his personal code of conduct to lay down the law. I once heard a rumor that he got so mad at that same rock star that he tipped off the paparazzi, who swarmed the star so much he never stayed at the Regency Grand again.
Mr. Preston, is it true? I once asked. Were you the one who called the paparazzi that time?
Never ask what a gentleman did or didn't do. If he's a true gentleman, he did it with good cause. And if he's a true gentleman, he'll never tell.
That's Mr. Preston. After passing him this morning, I swung through the massive front lobby and dashed down the stairs into the maze of hallways leading to the kitchen, the laundry rooms, and, my favorite rooms of all, the housekeeping quarters. They may not be grand, no brass, no marble, no velvet, but the housekeeping rooms are where I belong. Like I always do, I put on my fresh maid uniform and collected my housekeeping trolley, making sure it was replenished and ready for my rounds. It was not replenished, which is no surprise, since my supervisor, Cheryl Green, was the one on shift last night. Chernobyl is what most employees at the Regency Grand call her behind her back. To be clear, she's not from Chernobyl. In fact, she's not from Ukraine at all. She's lived her entire life in this city, as have I. Let it be known that while I do not think highly of Cheryl, I refuse to call her, or anyone, names. Treat others as you wish to be treated, Gran used to say, and that's a tenet I live by. I've been called many a thing in my quarter century, and what I've learned is that the common expression about sticks and stones is backward. sticks and stones often hurt far less than words. Cheryl may be my boss, but she's definitely not my superior. There is a difference, you know. You can't judge a person by the job they do or by their station in life. You must judge a person by their actions. Cheryl is slovenly and lazy. She cheats and cuts corners. She drags her feet when she walks. I've actually seen her clean a guest sink with the same cloth she used to clean their toilet. Can you believe such a thing? What are you doing? I asked the day I caught her in flagrante. That's not sanitary. Shoulder shrug. These guests barely tip. This'll teach them. Which is illogical. How are guests to know that the head maid just spread microscopic fecal matter around their sink? And how are they to know this means they need to tip better? As low to the ground as a squirrel's behind, is what Gran said when I told her about Cheryl and the toilet cloth. This morning, upon my arrival, my trolley was still full of damp, soiled towels and used soaps from the day before. If I were the boss of things, let me tell you this, I would relish the chance to restock the trolleys. It took me some time to replenish my wares, and by the time I was finished, Cheryl was finally arriving for her shift, late as usual, dragging her floppy feet behind her. I wondered if she'd rush to the top floor today as she usually did to do her first rounds, meaning to sneak to the penthouse suites that are mine to clean and steal my biggest tips off the pillows, leaving only the loose change behind for me. I know she does this, though I can't prove it. That's just the kind of person she is, a cheater, and not the Robin Hood kind. The Robin Hood kind takes for the greater good, restoring justice to those who've been wronged. This kind of theft is justified, whereas other kinds are not. But make no mistake, Cheryl is no Robin Hood. She steals from others for one reason only, to better herself at the expense of others. And that makes her a parasite, not a hero. I said my half-hearted hello to Cheryl and then greeted Sunshine and Sunita, the two other maids on shift with me. Sunshine is from the Philippines. Why are you named Sunshine? I asked her when we first met. For my bright smile, she said as she put a hand on one hip and made a flourish with her feather duster. I could see it then, the similarity, how the sun and sunshine were similar. Sunshine is bright and shiny. She talks a lot, and guests love her. Sunita is from Sri Lanka, and unlike Sunshine, she barely says a word. Good morning, I'll say to her when she's on shift with me. Are you well? She'll nod once and say a word or two and little else, which suits me just fine. She's agreeable to work with, and she does not slack or dilly-dally. I take no exception to other maids, provided they do their jobs well. One thing I will say, both Sunita and Sunshine know how to make up a room spotlessly, which, maid to maid, I respect. Once my trolley was set, I rolled down the hall to the kitchen to visit Juan Manuel. He is a fine colleague, always quite pleasant and collegial. I left my trolley outside the kitchen doors. Then I peeked through the glass. There he was, at the giant dishwasher, pushing racks of dishes through its maw. Other kitchen workers milled about, carrying food trays with silver covers, fresh triple-layer cakes, or other decadent delights. Juan Manuel's supervisor was nowhere to be seen, so now was a good time to enter. I crept along the perimeter until I reached Juan Manuel's workstation. "Hello," I said, probably too loudly, but I wanted to be heard above the whirring machine. Juan Manuel jumped and turned. "Híjole, you scared me." "Is now a good time?" I asked. "Yes," he replied, wiping his hands on his apron. He ran over to the large metal sink, grabbed a clean glass, and filled it with ice-cold water, which he handed to me. "Oh, thank you," I said. If the basement was warm, the kitchen was an inferno. I don't know how Juan Manuel does his job, standing for hours in the unbearable heat and humidity, scraping half-eaten food from plates. All that waste, all those germs. I visit him every day, and every day I try not to think about it. "I've got your key card. Room 308, early checkout today. I will clean the room now so it's ready for you whenever you want it, okay?" I'd been slipping Juan Manuel key cards for at least 2 months, ever since Rodney explained Juan Manuel's unfortunate situation. "Amiga mia, thank you so much," Juan Manuel said. "You'll be safe until 9 tomorrow morning, when Cheryl arrives.
She's not supposed to clean that floor at all, but with her, you just never know. It was then that I noticed the angry marks on his wrist, round and red. "What are those?" I asked. "Did you burn yourself?"
"Oh, yes, I burned myself on the washer, yes."
"That sounds like a safety infraction," I said. "Mr. Snow is very serious about safety. You should tell him and he'll have the machine looked at."
"No, no," Juan Manuel replied. "It was my mistake. I put my arm where it shouldn't go."
"Well," I said, "do be careful."
"I will," he answered.
He did not make eye contact with me during this part of the conversation, which was most unlike him. I concluded he was embarrassed by his mishap, so I changed the subject. "Have you heard from your family lately?" I asked.
"My mother sent me this yesterday."
He pulled a phone from his apron pocket and called up a photo. His family lives in northern Mexico. His father died over 2 years ago, which left the family short of income. Juan Manuel sends money home to compensate. He has 4 sisters, 2 brothers, 6 aunts, 7 uncles, and 1 nephew. He's the oldest of his siblings, about my age. The photo showed the entire family seated around a plastic table, all of them smiling for the camera. His mother stood at the head of the table, proudly holding a platter of barbecued meat. "This is why I'm here, in this kitchen, in this country, so my family can eat meat on Sundays. If my mother met you, Molly, she'd like you right away. My mother and me, we are alike. We know good people when we see them." He pointed to his mother's face in the photo. "Look, she never stops smiling, no matter what. Oh, Molly." Tears came to his eyes then. I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to look at any more pictures of his family. Every time I did, I felt an odd sensation in the pit of my stomach, the same feeling I got when I once accidentally knocked a guest's earring into the black hole of a drain. "I must be off," I said. 21 rooms to clean today."
"Okay, okay. It makes me happy when you visit. See you soon, Miss Molly."
I rushed out of the kitchen to the quiet, bright hallway and the perfect order of my trolley. Instantly, I felt much better. It was time to go to the social, the restaurant bar and grill inside the hotel where Rodney would be starting his shift. Rodney Stiles, head bartender. Rodney, with his thick, wavy hair, his white dress shirt with the top buttons tastefully undone, revealing just a little of his perfectly smooth chest. Well, almost perfectly smooth, minus 1 small round scar on his sternum. Anyhow, the point is, he isn't hairy. How any woman could like a hairy man is beyond me. Not that I'm prejudiced. I'm just saying that if a man I fancied was hairy, I'd get the wax out and I'd rip the strips off him until he was clean and bare. I have not yet had the opportunity to do this in real life. I've had only 1 boyfriend, Wilbur. And while he didn't have chest hair, he turned out to be a heartbreaker and a liar and a cheat. So perhaps chest hair isn't the worst thing in the world. I breathe deeply to cleanse my mind of Wilbur. I'm blessed with this ability to clean my mind as I would a room. I picture offensive people or recall uncomfortable moments, and I wipe them away. Gone. Erased. Just like that. My mind is returned to a state of perfection. But as I sit here, in Mr. Snow's office, waiting for him to return, I'm having trouble keeping my mind clean. It returns to thoughts of Mr. Black, to the feeling of his lifeless skin on my fingers, and so on. I take a sip of my tea, which is now cold. I will focus once more on the morning, on remembering every detail. Where was I? Ah, yes, Juan Manuel. After I left him, I headed to the elevator with my trolley, taking it up to the lobby. The doors opened and Mr. and Mrs. Chen were standing there. The Chens are regular guests, just like the Blacks, though the Chens are from Taiwan. Mr. Chen sells textiles, so I'm told. Mrs. Chen always travels with him. That day she was wearing a wine-colored dress with a lovely black fringe. The Chens are always flawlessly polite, a characteristic I find exceptional. They acknowledged me right away, which, let me just say, is rare for hotel guests. They even stepped aside so I could exit the elevator before they entered. "I thank you for being repeat guests, Mr. and Mrs. Chen." Mr. Snow taught me to greet guests by name, to treat them as I would family members.
It is we who thank you for keeping our room so orderly, said Mr. Chen. Mrs. Chen gets to rest while she's here.
I'm getting lazy. You do everything for me, Mrs. Chen said.
I am not one for attention-seeking behavior. I prefer to acknowledge a compliment with a nod or silence. At that moment, I nodded, curtsied, and said, please enjoy your stay. The Chens shuffled onto the elevator and the doors closed. The lobby was moderately busy, with new guests arriving and some checking out. At a glance, it appeared clean and orderly. No touch-ups required. Sometimes, however, guests will leave a newspaper in a state of disarray on a side table or discard a coffee cup on the clean marble floor where it spills its last drops and leaves an ominous blot. Whenever I notice such infelicities, I address them immediately. Strictly speaking, cleaning the lobby is not my job, but as Mr. Snow has said, good employees think outside of the box. I pushed my trolley to the entrance of the social bar and grill and parked it. Rodney was behind the bar, reading a newspaper spread on the bar top. I walked in briskly to show that I am a woman with confidence and a sense of purpose. I've arrived, I said. He looked up.
Oh, hey, Molly. Here for the morning papers?
Your assumption is 100% correct. Every day, I picked up a stack of newspapers to deliver to guest rooms as I made my rounds.
Have you seen this? He asked, pointing to the newspaper in front of him. He wears a very shiny Rolex watch.
Even though I'm not much of a brand person, I'm well aware that Rolex is an expensive brand, which must mean Mr. Snow recognizes Rodney's superior abilities as a bartender and pays him more than a usual bartender's salary. I looked at the headline Rodney pointed at, Family Feud Rocks Black Empire. May I see that?
Sure.
He turned the article my way. It featured several photos, a large one of Mr. Black in his classic double-breasted suit, fending off reporters who were sticking cameras in his face. Giselle was on his arm, perfectly styled from head to toe, wearing dark sunglasses. Judging from her outfit, the photo was taken recently, perhaps yesterday?
Looks like trouble's brewing in the Black family, Rodney said. Seems his daughter Victoria is 49% shareholder of the Black business empire, and he wants those shares back.
I scanned the article. The Blacks had three children, all of them grown up. One of the boys lived in Atlantic City. The other flitted from Thailand to the Virgin Islands or wherever else the party happened to be. In the article, Mrs. Black, the first Mrs. Black, described her two sons as flakes and was quoted saying, "The only way Black properties and investments will survive is if my daughter Victoria, who essentially already runs the organization, becomes a half shareholder at least." The article went on to describe the nasty legal jabs between Mr. Black and his ex-missus. A host of other power magnates were referenced in the article, rallying on one side or the other. The article suggested that Mr. Black's second marriage to Giselle 2 years ago, a woman less than half his age, marked the beginning of destabilization within the Black Empire. Poor Giselle, I said aloud.
Right, Rodney replied. She doesn't need this.
A thought occurred to me. How well do you know her, Giselle? Rodney whisked the paper away and slid it under the bar, bringing out a fresh stack for me to take upstairs.
Who?
Giselle, I said.
Mr. Black doesn't let her come down here to the bar. You probably have more contact with her than I do.
He was right. I did. I do. An unlikely and pleasing bond, dare I say friendship, has recently formed between us. Between the young and beautiful Giselle Black, second wife of the infamous property mogul, and me, Molly, insignificant room maid. I don't talk about our bond much, because Mr. Preston's adage applies equally to gentle women as to gentlemen. Best to keep my lips pressed shut. I waited for Rodney to extend the conversation, leaving the kind of ample room that a single but not desperate female might leave were she romantically interested in the eligible bachelor before her, whose cologne hinted of bergamot and exotic masculine mystique. I was not disappointed, not entirely at least.
Molly, your newspapers.
He leaned on the bar, the muscles in his forearms contracting attractively. Since this was a bar and not a dinner table, the no elbows on the table rule did not apply. And Molly, by the way, thanks.
for what you're doing to help my friend Juan Manuel. You're really a special girl.
I felt a surge of warmth rush to my cheeks as if Gran had just pinched them.
I'd do the same for you, probably more. I mean, that's what you do for friends, right? You help them out of binds.
He put one of his hands on my wrist and subtly squeezed. The sensation was extremely pleasing, and I realized suddenly how long it had been since I'd been touched at all by anyone. He pulled away long before I was ready. I waited for him to say something more, to ask me on another date, perhaps. I wanted nothing more than a second rendezvous with Rodney Stiles. Our first occurred well over 1 year ago and remains a highlight of my adult life. But I waited in vain. He turned to the coffee station and began making a fresh pot.
"You'd better get upstairs," he said, "or Chernobyl's gonna drop a bomb on you."
I laughed. More of a guffaw slash cough, actually. I was laughing with Rodney, not at Cheryl, which surely made it okay.
"Speaking with you has been delightful," I said to Rodney. "Perhaps we can do it another time," I prompted.
"You bet," he said. "I'm here all week, haha."
"Of course you are," I said matter-of-factly.
"It was a joke," he replied with a wink.
Though I did not get the joke, I most definitely understood the wink. I floated out of the bar and collected my trolley. I could hear my heart in my ears, the excitement pumping.
Through the lobby I wheeled, nodding at guests as I walked. "Discreet courtesy, invisible but present customer service," Mr. Snow often says. This is a manner I've cultivated, though I must admit it comes rather easily to me. I believe my gran taught me a lot about this way of being, though the hotel has offered me ample opportunity to practice and perfect. This morning, I carried a happy tune in my head as I took the elevator up to the fourth floor. I headed to Mr. and Mrs. Black's suite, suite 401. Just as I was about to knock on their door, it opened, and Mr. Black stormed out. He was dressed in his trademark double-breasted suit, with a paper sticking out of his left breast pocket, on it the word DEED, in little curlicue letters. He nearly knocked me over with the brute force of his exit.
"Out of my way!"
He often did this, bowled me over or treated me like I was invisible. "My apologies, Mr. Black," I said. "Have an enjoyable day." I stuck my foot in the door to keep it open, then decided I should still knock.
"Housekeeping," I called.
Giselle was seated on the divan in the sitting room, wearing a bathrobe, her head in her hands. Was she crying? I was not entirely sure. Her hair, sleek, long, and dark, was disheveled. It made me quite nervous, her hair in that state.
"Is this a good time for me to return your suite to a state of perfection?" I asked.
Giselle looked up. Her face was red, her eyes swollen. She grabbed her phone off the glass tabletop, got up, and ran to the bathroom, slamming the door behind her. She switched on the fan, which, I noted, sounded loud and clunky. I would have to report that to the maintenance department. Next, she turned on the shower.
"Well then," I called loudly through the bathroom door. "If you don't mind, I'll just tidy up in here while you prepare yourself to seize the day."
No answer.
"I said, I'll just clean in here, since you haven't actually answered me."
Nothing. It was unlike Giselle to behave in this manner. She was usually quite talkative whenever I cleaned her suite. She'd engage me in conversation, and in her presence, I felt something I rarely did with others. I felt comfortable, like I was sitting at home on the sofa with Gran. I called out to her one more time.
"My Gran always said that the best way to feel better is by tidying up. If you feel sad, just grab a duster, Buster."
But she couldn't hear me above the running water and the clunky whirring of the fan. I busied myself with cleaning, starting in the sitting room. The glass tabletop was a mess of smudges and fingerprints. People's propensity to generate filth never ceases to amaze me. I grabbed my ammonia bottle and set to work, returning the table to a high and mighty shine. I surveyed the room. The curtains were open. Fortunately, the windows had not been smeared by fingerprints, which was at least one blessing. On the bureau, by the door, were some envelopes, opened. A ripped corner lay curled on the floor. I retrieved it and threw it in the trash. Beside the correspondence was Giselle's yellow purse with the gold chain link strap. It looked valuable, but you'd never know it from the way she flung it about. The zipper at the top was open, and sticking out was a flight itinerary. I'm not one to snoop, but I couldn't help notice it was for 2 one-way flights to the Cayman Islands. Were this my purse, I would always close the zipper and make sure my precious valuables weren't about to fall out. I took it upon myself to place the purse exactly parallel to the mail and arrange the chain strap neatly. I surveyed the room. The carpet had been well trampled, the pile disturbed on both sides, as if someone, Mr. Black or Giselle, or both, had been pacing back and forth. I took my vacuum from my trolley and plugged it in. "Pardon the ruckus," I called out. I vacuumed the room in straight lines until the carpet plumped right up and looked like a newly swept Zen garden. I've never actually visited a Zen garden in real life, but Gran and I used to holiday together on the sofa, side by side in our living room. "Where shall we travel tonight?" she would ask. "To the Amazon with David Attenborough, or to Japan with National Geographic?" That night, I chose Japan, and Gran and I learned all about Zen gardens. This was before she was sick, of course. I no longer engage in armchair travel because I can't afford cable or even Netflix. Even if I did have the money, it wouldn't be the same to armchair travel without Gran. Right now, as I sit in Mr. Snow's office replaying my day, it strikes me again just how odd it was that Giselle stayed in the bathroom for so long this morning. It was almost as though she didn't want to speak with me. After vacuuming, I moved on to the bedroom. The bed was rumpled, no tip on the pillows, which was a disappointment. I will admit that I've come to count on the generous tips from the Blacks. They've gotten me through the last few months now that I'm a one-salary household and can't count on Gran's earnings to help pay the rent. I set about removing the bed sheets and crisply made up the bed, complete with perfect hospital corners and 4 plump, hotel-standard pillows, 2 hard, 2 soft, 2 pillows each for husband and wife. The closet door was ajar, but when I went to shut it, I couldn't because the safe inside was open. I could see 1 passport inside the safe, not 2, some documents that looked very legal, and several stacks of money. Crisp, new $100 notes, at least 5 stacks in total. It's hard to admit this, even to myself, but I am in the midst of a financial crisis. And while I'm not proud of the fact, it is nevertheless the truth that the piles of money sitting in that safe tempted me, so much so that I tidied the rest of the room as fast as I could, shoes pointing straight, negligee folded on the dressing chair, and so on, just so I could leave the bedroom and finish cleaning the rest of the suite quickly. I returned to the sitting room, where I tended to the bar and the mini-fridge. 5 small bottles of Bombay gin were missing, hers, I presumed, and 3 mini-bottles of scotch, definitely his. I replenished the stock and then emptied all the trash cans. I heard the shower turn off at long last and the fan as well, and then I heard the unmistakable sound of Giselle sobbing. She sounded very sad, so I announced that the suite was clean, took a tissue box from my trolley, and waited outside the bathroom door. Eventually, she emerged. She was wrapped in one of the hotel's fluffy white bathrobes. I've always wondered what it must be like to wear one of those robes. It must feel like being hugged by a cloud. She had a bath towel around her hair, too, in a perfect swirl, like my favorite treat, ice cream. I held the tissue box out to her. "Need a tissue for your issue?" I asked. She sighed. "You're sweet," she said, "but a tissue isn't going to cut it." She walked around me and into the bedroom. I could hear her rooting around in her armoire. "Are you quite all right?" I asked. "Can I help you in any way?"
"Not today, Molly. I don't have the energy, okay?"
Her voice was different, like a flat tire if it could talk, which of course it can't, except in cartoons. It was evident to me that she was most upset. "Very well," I said in a chipper voice. "May I clean your bathroom now?"
"No, Molly, I'm sorry, please, not right now."
I did not take this personally. "I'll come back later to clean it then?"
"Good idea," she said.
I curtsied in response to her compliment, then retrieved my trolley and buzzed myself out the door. I set about cleaning the other rooms and suites on that floor, feeling increasingly unsettled as I did so. What was wrong with Giselle? Normally, she talked about where she was going that day, what she was doing. She solicited my opinion about whether she should wear this or that. She said pleasing things. Molly Maid, there's no one like you. You're the best, and never forget it. The warmth would rise to my face. I'd feel my chest expand a bit with every kind word. It was also unlike Giselle to forget to tip me. We're all entitled to a bad day now and again, I heard Gran say in my head. But when they are all bad days with no pleasant ones, then it's time to reconsider things. I moved on to Mr. and Mrs. Chen's room a few doors down. Cheryl was just about to enter. I was going to take the dirty sheets downstairs for you, as a favor, she said.
That's quite all right. I've got it, I replied, pushing past her with my trolley. But thank you for your kindness.
I buzzed through, allowing the door to shut abruptly on her scowling face. On the pillow in the Chen's bedroom was a crisp $20 bill. For me. An acknowledgement of my work, of my existence, of my need.
That's kindness, Cheryl, I said out loud as I folded the 20 and tucked it into my pocket.
As I cleaned, I fantasized about all the things I would do. Spray bleach in her face, strangle her with a bathrobe tie, push her off the balcony, if I ever caught Cheryl red-handed, stealing tips from one of my rooms.